boy, do I have Honest and Doomsday-y. But, before we do that, we got some Australian music, and I'm gonna give you a little background on this song and the band before we play the track. First of all, the song, which you would know many versions of this song, of We Gotta Get Out of This Place. And from the Wikipedia on the song, is a song written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil and recorded as a 1965 hit single by The Animals. It's become an iconic song of its type and was immensely popular among the United States Armed Forces during the Vietnam War. But it is one of the most covered rock and roll songs in history, I reckon. Where'd the thing go? No, I can't find it. I have a list here somewhere of other versions. Where'd you go? Oh, here we go. It was done in 1972 by the Partridge Family. Bruce Springsteen has performed it a handful of times over the years, but has acknowledged it as one of his primary influences in the 1970s. Blue Oyster Cult has done it. Angelic Upstarts in 1980, Grand Funk Railroad in 1981, David Johansen in 1982, Fear did it in 1982. The version we're going to play today, though, is from Australia's one of the greatest pub bands of the pub band era, the Angels. They did this track in 1986. It's also done by Richard Thompson in 1988, Jello Biafra and DOA in 1989, Randy Stonehill in 1990, Bon Jovi did it in 92, Space did it in 98, Southside Johnny has been doing it live for years, and Ann Wilson with Wynonna Judd in 2007. I'd like to hear that version. I dig both of them, especially Ann Wilson. Also, Barry Mann revisited the song, performing it with Brian Adams on A Man's Retrospective. Now, I got to tell you a little bit about the Angels, the first band I toured this country with. Back in 1999, they re-released a live album of theirs called Live Line, and so they were going out and running again. And Doc Neeson was the front man, and the Brewster Brothers played guitars. And the Brewster Brothers are a couple of really nice chaps. And in fact, Rick is really funny. His nickname is The Prop, because during the show, he doesn't move, but he's a great rhythm guitar player, and he's just, you know, one of these riff monster guys, you know, virtually expressionless, and he just kind of hammers out these riffs with just unbelievable precision. And you know, the Angels were a really kind of somewhat dark band, imagery-wise. Lighting was always really good, even in the pub days. Unfortunately, the tour that I did was a bit of a disaster. We might not get into the details of that. Let's just say old Johnny didn't come out faring too well. But hey, that's what happens when you have a cheap, put-together, duct-taped, sticky-taped PA system. however, I've run into the boys in recent years on things, and it seemed like there was no ill will, and a few good jokes were cracked, and Johnny turned to me and said, "You got a joint?" And I went, "I might, but that's a whole nother deal." But anyway, the album, forgetting the name of the album that this is on, but this is from 1986, and I really dig this version. I forgot that the recorded version had horns on it and slightly 80s-sounding keyboard pads on it. But you kind of let that go, and you hear just a five-piece rock band that had an American bass player just absolutely just hammering it out. And I reckon this is one of my favorite versions of this song. And maybe it's just because it's become part of Australian history with the Angels. I mean, you can't talk about Australian pub rock without mentioning the Angels. So without further ado, from 1986, Australia's Angels with We Gotta Get Out of This Place. Roll it, Bob. You can't beat it. These days, the Angels still play, but they play without Doc Neeson. And actually, Doc came into the band a couple of years into their existence, and John Brewster used to do most of the vocals. And the tour that I did with them was, as far as I know, the last tour that Doc did, and he was starting to fall quite ill at that time. I don't know how he's doing these days. I know he's quite ill. When we were on the road, when I first went out, you know, here's the new American, you know, down here in Australia, and I get this opportunity to go out with this legendary band in this country. I'm told, you know, don't talk to Doc. No one talks to Doc. And I'm thinking, why the hell not? And after the first gig, I could tell that Doc was crook. He has terrible asthma. And, you know, he was going off stage to the oxygen tank and had his bubbler and all that kind of stuff going on. And, you know, was going for steroid shots to keep himself going, which is a common practice on the road for singers that fall ill. You can't do it too often, but, you know, you got a big crowd and your voice is failing. A steroid shot can boost up your voice and get you through a couple of nights, you know, so that hopefully you get to the days off and can get healthy again. And, you know, the first part of the run went really quite well before things went a little pear-shaped. And, you know, after the first gig, I went and, you know, said hi to Doc, introduced myself, and said, you know, I can see that you're, you know, that you're not feeling so well, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you got to tell me how you're feeling so I can respond to you. And every gig after that, he'd come up during sound check, come up, I'd be the first person basically that he'd come up and say hello to and come and chat with me. And, you know, I looked over at the tour manager and said, yeah, don't talk to Doc, bite me. But hey, that's the world of touring. I think more the touring manager. And it was a really interesting thing. We had a tour manager that didn't make it on the tour. It's kind of hard for when you have production problems and the guy who runs the checkbook, you know, not being there, for you to have anything to be done about it. And you end up just kind of being screwed the same way night after night. But hey, that's all in the past. The Angels are still going. And I tell you, they call themselves the Original Angels at the moment. And they've got their old drummer back and whatnot, and it's great. It's really great. And it's just five guys out there just hammering it, and it's just fantastic stuff. And we might visit a couple of other more obscure Angel tracks in the future, because there's a couple of them that I particularly love, and I've just kind of reacquired some of this music, and it's been kind of fun to go through and listen. And, you know, even though the tour may not have gone as well as I would have hoped, it still is an experience that I will never have given up, because I get to say that I actually toured with the Angels. Hey. actually, one of Alice Cooper's favorite bands. And Alice Cooper, they don't even list it, but Alice Cooper covered that song. And he covered another Angels track. I can't think of which one. And it's really funny. Iggy Pop's covered an Angels tune. And they never really got exposure in the States. But yet, Guns N' Roses, the name Guns N' Roses even is pulled from an Australian band, from Rose Tattoo. And we'll have to visit some of them as well. That's some really, really great pub rock. But we should move on to some green news. Now, Gene sent me this, and I usually don't like reading this kind of stuff, but hey, sometimes a bit of a whack of reality is what's needed. And, you know, I said before, you know, sometimes people say, you know, you cover all the depressing stuff. And I try not to be like that. I try to look at the positives, all the things that we can do to make it better, to change the way we do things, to avoid the catastrophe that we're kind of running head on into. So from dailymail.co.uk. We're all doomed. 40 years from global catastrophe, and there's nothing we can do about it, says climate change expert. Now, I don't necessarily think that this is the attitude to have, but however, it does pull some focus on really how we have to act now. And it says, the weather forecast for this holiday weekend is wildly unsettled. We had better get used to it. According to the climate change scientist James Lovelock, this is the beginning of the end of a peaceful phase in evolution. I imagine there are certain people that would have read that line and changed pages. But anyway, that's the fact. It is evolution. By 2040, the world population of more than 6 billion will have been culled by floods, drought, and famine. The people of Southern Europe, as well as Southeast Asia, will be fighting their way into countries such as Canada, Australia, and Britain. We will, he says, have to set up encampments in this country, like those established for the hundreds of thousands of refugees displaced by the conflict in East Africa. Now, this is all very much the stuff that Al Gore spoke about in An Inconvenient Truth, but this is a little bit more stripped down and in your face. Lovelock believes the subsequent ethnic tensions could lead to civil war. Crackpot or visionary, the fact is that more and more people are paying attention to Lovelock, and that he himself supports the International Governmental Planet on Climate Change, the influential group who shared the Nobel Peace Prize with former American Vice President Al Gore for their campaigns on global warming. Lovelock also says that Margaret Thatcher and the Queen are sympathetic to his views. Margaret Thatcher? You're kidding. Okay, maybe she's only 99% pure evil. He has been proclaiming his Gaia theory for a generation. This states that the Earth is a living, self-regulating system, and that by filling its atmosphere with CO2, we have destroyed the balance and overheated the planet. We are in a phase when the thermometer suddenly shoots up. Lovelock believes it is too late to repair the damage. Government targets are futile. Britain contributes such a tiny amount of emissions compared with countries such as China that our self-regulatory measures are pathetic. Everyone could burn coal all day and drive around in 4x4s and would not make a scrap of difference, he says. It is hubris, he argues, to believe that we can prevent the inevitable consequences of mankind's actions. Lovelock reminds us, in case it has slipped our memory, that the Earth has gone through exactly the same correction before. It was last as hot as this 55 million years ago. There was a geological accident in the North Sea, near where Norway is. A volcanic layer of lava came up underneath one of the large petroleum deposits. It vaporized the whole lot, putting into the atmosphere about 2 million tons of crude oil. I didn't stutter there. 2 million tons. We have put that much into the atmosphere within the... We will have put that much into the atmosphere within the next 20 years or so. We know what happened last time. We know how long it lasted. It hung around for about 200,000 years. It may have been primitive creatures rather than people who were landed with the problem last time around, but their survival strategy was instructive. Everything moved to the north, Lovelock explains. The Arctic Ocean was tropical. The sea temperatures were 23 degrees Celsius or 73 degrees Fahrenheit. You could find the remains of crocodiles in the sediments. Such a residue of the past has guided Lovelock through his decades of investigation. The Prophet of Doom is a distinguished scientist who has made a companion of honor and who has a great invention to his name. He perfected the electron capture detector, which sought out poisons in the atmosphere and discovered CFCs puncturing the ozone layer as well as pesticides. So this is the guy that was responsible for actually, identifying ozone. So, I mean, we're not talking about some fly-by-night character here. He is now a sprightly 88-year-old with infinite curiosity and lives with his American second wife, Sandy, who is about 20 years his junior, in a modest farmhouse in the middle of a nature reserve about 35 acres in Cornwall. He has 4 children and 9 grandchildren. He does not look like a man willing our extinction, yet he says he welcomes the next evolutionary step, even if he is a victim of it. He is convinced that something momentous is about to happen. The signs are evident, even in his own nature reserve. The place is growing visibly more like a jungle. There is growth of brambles and spreading vegetation. Brambles, unlike their traditional English meadow image, are just the start of the takeover of jungle vegetation. Lovelock expects the same changes among wildlife. Polar bears will not become extinct. They will just go back to what they were, which is brown bears. Nature is adapting to the changing climate, and Lovelock argues that mankind will have to do the same. We will face a ruthless period of natural selection. I reckon there are about 80% more people than the world can carry, he says sanguinely. And this is one of the hardest things to... This is one of the hardest things to accept, that the Industrial Revolution has made it possible to maintain a population that we wouldn't be able to maintain otherwise, because, you know, mechanized food production, yada, 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 yada. Now, I think we can avoid the worst part of it, or at least stave it off and give ourselves more time to adapt. Going back to some of the stuff that Bob and I were talking about,
woke up this morning, I suddenly realized we're all in this together. I started smiling, 'cause you were smiling, and we're all in this together. I'm made of atoms, you're made of atoms, and we're all in this together. And long division just doesn't matter, 'cause we're all in this together. Yeah. I saw you walking in the city. We're all in this together. The city's changing. Every 12 seconds, someone remembers that we're all in this together. In the kitchen of your rent control apartment, we're all in this together. Come on, baby, I don't mean to rush you. I only wanted to reach out and touch you. I've got to stop. Think about jumping ship before it sinks, but we are all in this together. In this together. Yeah, I love you and you love her. She loves him, but we are all in this together.
done. Shuffle Kings. Well done there, Bob. Well done. Gotta love the Shuffle Kings. Great Australian band. Not signed. That's all self-produced. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant stuff. Good mates, too. Anyway, okay. Maybe the subject was so depressing that my wireless connection just decided that, no, no, don't want to hear it. So we've gotten rid of the wireless connection. We're back on the hardwired one, as we should have been from the start. Hopefully we're all good. So where the hell was I going? We're going to get off of that. I did think this was also very, very interesting. I'll do this other one really quick. Betsy sent me this, and I also saw this in the Huffington Post yesterday. And, you know, while we're having, you know, all this stuff about the election, you know, and diversionary, you know, nonsense subjects taking up our time and our media, we don't hear about the stuff that lawmakers have been getting up to while we're not paying attention. And so from Common Dreams via The Guardian, U.S. authority failing to list endangered species. Bald eagles, wolves, snails, butterflies, and many other species native to the U.S. have long been at risk. Many have made it onto the country's endangered species list, but not under the Bush administration over the last 2 years. Conservation groups claim that the Bush appointees have been deliberately making it harder to designate animals and plants as endangered and have launched a series of lawsuits. Administration officials admit that there are about 280 species waiting to be added to the list. George Bush's father designated 231 species as endangered or threatened in a single term. In Bill Clinton's 8 years, over 521 species were designated as endangered. Bush has designated 59 in 7 years, and none in the last two since Dirk Kempthorne became Secretary of the Interior, the department responsible. Conservation groups such as the Sierra Group said Kempthorne, a former senator and head of the Housing Development Group, was biased in favor of commercial interests. Oh, surprise, frickin' surprise. Huh. The lack of urgency in the U.S. comes against a background of concerns worldwide that conservationists are losing the battle. That fear was summed up last year by the Red List of the World Conservation Union Environmental Network. Its list defined 16,306 species are vulnerable, endangered, or critically endangered. And it's just one of those, what you don't know won't hurt you. You wanker. But see, this is what we get. This is what we get when we allow a brainless little crony and his little buddies to come in and run the place. You know, the nutters are running the asylum. It's all falling apart. The Washington Post yesterday published internal documents from the Interior Department showing that officials have frequently overruled recommendations from scientists. See, it's more of the Bush administration attack on science. The lack of recent designations could be motivated by various interests, such as the desire not to see oil exploration or housing development shackled by a need to protect habitats that are home to threatened species. Why should you care about a spotted owl? Because I do. Why don't you? You wanker. Officials at the Interior Department insisted the real reason was that it had been hampered since the 1990s by lawsuits from conservation and other groups. A relatively new group, the Wild Earth Guardians, based in the American West, filed a lawsuit on Wednesday seeking a court order to protect 681 species at once, including snails, butterflies, and plants. Because it's that small end of, you know, the whole friggin' system If that goes, the bigger bits, like us, are affected more drastically than when, you know, we lose large predators. But losing large predators is really bad, too, because when we lose the large predators, smaller species that are usually population-controlled run rampant, and that ends up causing other run-on problems. You know, going back to the first article, depressing as it was, Lovelock's representation of the Earth and its atmosphere being, you know, a system of balance is absolutely spot on. I've spoken about this for you know, years now. And I mean, even, you know, even with my somewhat limited but a little bit more than the average person grasp of physics, it's all very, very obvious. I'm sometimes amazed at the physics education that I have for audio, because, I mean, you study motion physics, because it's, you know, audio engineering is not just about electronics, but it's also about motion physics and about energy, static, kinetic, da-da-da-da-da. And energy's got to go somewhere. It all really makes scientific sense. That's why we got to get these idiots out of office, and we got to stop, you know, allowing religious nut jobs and people of extreme faith. We got to get rid of these people and stop this attack on actual science, on actual understanding of our world, because it is so unbelievably dangerous. Now, this other piece, and I've wrestled with this on and off at times while doing this program. There's a great piece at Gristmill, at grist.org, from Chris Mooney. It's not kryptonite, after all. Does refuting deniers only strengthen and empower them? And this is an interesting train of thought, because if you get so caught up trying to convince a few idiots and a few people who have blinders on or have well-vested interests in things that are going to kill the rest of us, are we losing the fight by putting too much focus on these people that deny the facts? Here it says, science journalist Chris Mooney, author of a must-read, The Republican War on Science, had a post at Science Progress entitled Enablers. Sometimes refuting unscientific nonsense reinforces it. This is a provocative and timely post given the recent tussles I've been having with deniers and delayers. And see, that's one of the tactics that's coming up. The deniers have come into delayers going, well, we can't act too fast. Let's not be irrational now. And it's like, no, we're not being irrational. We've been talking about the same damn thing for decades. And it's about stalling tactics. I've talked to Chris and his occasional co-blogger, Matthew Nisbet, who has a related post, and there's links all there, many times. And while we are probably 95% in agreement on most things, I don't quite buy their argument here. So we've reached a point where we may well be wasting our energies if we continue to battle climate skeptics. Indeed, we run the risk of propping them up far more than they deserve. It's a thing, you know. Shining the light on the idiots, are we giving them too much, you know, too much time? For that's the problem with constantly rebutting anti-science forces. Not only does it waste our time, but it may play right into their hands. Consider, over at his blog, Framing Science, Matthew Nisbet makes a very strong case that the rhetorical strategy of the Heartland Institute is exceedingly similar to that of the anti-evolutionist think tank, the Discovery Institute. If so, it follows that the defenders of climate science ought to be at least as leery of outright engagement with Heartland as the defenders of evolutionary science are when it comes to engaging with Discovery. The reason is that you actually bother to rebut the Heartlands and Discoveries of the world, you instantly enter a discourse on their own terms. The strategic framing these groups employ to attack mainstream science heavily features the rhetoric of scientific uncertainty. And we've seen this time and time again. The key issue is what Chris means by battle climate skeptics. I tend to agree that it is pointless to debate them one-on-one, as the listening audience can hardly be expected to adjudicate scientific arguments. So it is a losing proposition, and I rarely waste my time doing it anymore. And as I've recently blogged, I think it's also a waste of time for me to keep rebutting long-debunked denier talking points that someone posts in the comments of this blog. But I do a lot of radio shows, and conservatives and libertarians, most but not all well-meaning people, inevitably call in repeating old and new denier talking points, the same for lectures I give. I must rebut these points clearly and succinctly, or I will convince nobody. All progressives need to have that ability, even if they don't give talks on the subject, but merely argue with a non-progressive friend or relative. So I feel some obligation to rebut new denier talking points, like the earth is cooling crap. One advantage of doing it on a blog is that one can build up an entire database of links about the problem and the solution, so I and others have to keep rebutting these same points, or don't have to keep rebutting these same points, pardon me. You can just refer people to the relevant posts, either here or at a few other sites that do this. That said, I'm a big believer in strategic framing, which is why I use the word delayer more than denier. Although I still use the term denier occasionally in headlines, for instance, since it's better known, delayer or delayer 1000 focuses the debate on the need for action and makes clear that the goal of the deniers is to delay action. And that's what I insist people who want to engage in a debate answer the question. If you are running national and global climate policy, what level of CO2 concentrations would be your goal, and how would you achieve it? Because if we go into the 1,000 parts per million atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, then all debate and uncertainty in the science disappears. The planet's livability will be destroyed for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. I do not believe the climate issue has much analogy to the evolution issue. The creationist intelligent designers are mainly arguing over science in the public arena primarily because they don't want evolution taught. The stakes are very low, at best. You end up with some poorly educated kids in the country falls behind in biotech research that someone else will do. The denier delayers are mainly arguing over science in the public arena because they don't want action on climate. The stakes, in contrast, are enormous. If they succeed in delaying carbon much longer, we will be condemning the next 10 billion people who walk the earth to untold misery and strife. The public, and hence the media, need to get the facts on climate science and climate solutions much more than they need to get the facts about evolution. Don't get me wrong, though. Scientists need to vigorously defend evolution, and that means everybody needs to be educated about science. And this is, I mean, we know we've had this war on science, and it's gotten so bad now, you can have 2 plus 2, M5, and get to be marked right in some schools in some states in the United States. I mean, what is it going to be next? How far is it going to go? You get a ticket for going through a red light and going, no, my religion says that red means go faster. And you cannot fine me for hitting that car because in my God tells me, or my preacher, who is a back-ass word fool, tells me all my babies are arrows for God. That one still drives me crazy. Yeah, I brought you in this world to be a projectile weapon. But Matt writes, in the case, just like with evolution, sometimes the best way to respond is to not focus on the science. Instead, shift the train of thought for the public. Reaffirm the overwhelming scientific agreement from U.S. organizations such as the National Academies, the National Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Geophysical Union, and now even the Bush White House. But then quickly shift frames of reference discussing the moral and religious duty to take action. The missed opportunity for economic growth and technological development if we don't act now, and the public health threat to children, elderly, and the most vulnerable in cities, from increased rates of asthma, allergies, and deaths from heat stroke. And I think that there is this, there is a great point to this. You know, not that I think, you know, the former Nazi with the funny hat really plays much of a part in anything, but I did take it as a positive thing when damage to the environment was added to the deadly sins list. You know, if churches and religions actually take on the caretaker of the earth aspect of their teachings, they're going to get a whole lot more leniency from me. I'll play a whole lot more ball. I'll be a whole lot more forgiving. But the writer continues, yes, well, that's fine, but if there's a denier, a delayer, or just someone who is uninformed or a member of the media present, they will inevitably grill you on the science and the last denier talking point. After all, anyone can see how absurd it would be for government to require an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 if we weren't quite sure that the failure to do so would have devastating consequences. Put another way, I spent 15 years publishing the clean tech opportunity story, along with the co-benefits of cleaner air, lower oil imports, new high-tech jobs, etc., and all I can say is that nobody cares much about that stuff by itself, certainly not in the media. The powers that be in Congress. Frankly, I wouldn't care one iota about carbon dioxide reductions if I didn't understand how overwhelming the science case against inaction is. Mooney also writes, a great example occurred recently in the Heartland Institute's Climate Skeptic Conference in New York. Climate skepticism is totally passé. This event should have been completely ignored. Instead, many of my intellectual allies were screaming their heads off denouncing it and thereby drawing greater attention to it. I think that there is a great point here. You know, we've had similar discussions, you know, when we go off at some of the more vile talk show hosts. You know, are we only doing them a favor by shining the light on them as often as we have at times? And I think there's an argument for it, but it's sometimes quite unavoidable because you just get so outraged at the stupidity or just the sheer just gall of these people to lie when they probably actually know better. But it does, you know, they're either being paid. I mean, tobacco science, we know this. Being paid to deny. Or they're just stupid. I mean, really. And for those that go, there's also a small aspect of the left that, and this one just completely makes my head cave in. You'll get some factions in the left saying that the whole global warming campaign is all about one world government. And I just say, you know, I'm sorry. You're looking for something that just isn't there. Not saying that there might not be an evil bastard or two that wouldn't try and utilize the science and the need to change the way we run our societies for the wrong reason. And there you have to be careful. It's just also like with the commercialization of the green movement. You have to be wary of greenwashers. Those that sell green but aren't. It's amazing. For all the ground that we make, we still have this really small percentage of people that get undue attention for being just factually wrong. Yeah, Walmart could have qualified as a greenwasher in a few aspects. Bob is mentioning in the chat. You probably remember last year the photos of their organic foods that weren't organic, but they were sure stiffing the public for high profits by labeling stuff that they knew wasn't organic. So, I mean, you really, really have to be very, very careful. That's why go to your local green grocer if you've got one. Your local farmer's market if you've got one. Don't trust outfits like Walmart to do the right thing, because they're not going to do it. They're just not going to do it. And by taking the income away from them and putting it into people that do the right thing, you're not only doing the right thing environmentally, getting healthier food, but you know what? You can look in the face, the grower, who you are actually helping to support, and you know that every time you go and buy a bushel of tomatoes from them, that you're actually helping their family directly. Now, Bob also references that Bill Clinton was praising Wally World for advances in going green. Now, they have done some huge things about actually getting about alternative energy for their own stores. Huge amounts of solar power, and that part I can that part's cool. I'm down with that. But see, that's a financial. They're not doing it to be green. They're doing it because electricity is getting so damn expensive, and they run these huge box stores that are just absolute air conditioning and heating. You know, just you know vacuums running. You know, tens of thousands of watts of fluorescent lighting to light them up. So it's only smart business practice to go, hey, you know what? We spent a few grand on sticking solar panels on all of our buildings within, you know, a short period of time. Geez, they're going to pay themselves off. And we're going to have free energy. And what we don't use, the power company is going to pay us for. And so that's not about being green. That's actually about business. It's about business. And so this is where even the worst of the worst are seeing the writing on the wall. Whether they say it's climate change or not, they're seeing peak oil. Another reason why we need alternative sources of energy. We're just running out. You know, we just don't, it's not gonna be there. We talk about that we've hit peak oil now. I'm sorry, I disagree. We started hitting peak oil in the 70s. The United States and Iran hit peak oil in 1974, if you actually go and do the reading. It's in 1974 that the United States turned around and started importing more oil than we produced ourselves. And there's where we started dealing with the budget deficits. So local generation, all that kind of stuff, that means local jobs, that means local power. So, I mean, to be part of this, you have to be so on your toes all the time. It's unreal. Shepherd Books asking, I assume that the reading is accurate. I'm not sure exactly what reading he's talking about. But I'll try and maybe clear that up tomorrow night, or try and figure it out, because we're running out of time. Funny that. Thanks for being here again, folks. Thanks to Bob Kincaid for producing as usual. Thanks to Scott Barry at B1 Louder Productions for the music. Thank you to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, finding a solution to mountaintop removal. And thanks to Ben Birch at the White Rose Society for keeping the streaming going, and everybody else who makes everything happen on the network. Be good. Be green. We'll see you.
And the sign said, long-haired, freaky people need not apply. So I tucked my hair up under my hat, and I went in to ask him why. He said, you look like a fine, upstanding young man. I think you do. So I took off my hat. I said, imagine that. Huh, me working for you. Whoa.
Sign, sign, everywhere a sign. Lots of
sight. So I jumped on the fence and I yelled at the house, "Hey, what gives you the right? Put up a fence to keep me out, or to keep Mother Nature in? If God was here, he'd tell you to your face, man, you're some kind of sinner." Sign, sign, everywhere a sign, blocking out the scenery, breaking my mind. Do this, don't do that. Can't you?
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Many of you know that I spent last week at the Take Back America conference right here in Washington, D.C. And when I was there, I was able to interview a large number of various progressive voices. Some of you heard me last week interviewing them live with Guy James at my side. Well, I'm back here in the studio, but there were many interviews that I did that I couldn't do live, that I did at various